abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Monday, February 24th, 2014. My apologies for being about an hour late getting you guys this program. This is the first time we've been late with a program in over 100 shows, so it's a miracle we got this far without any problems. It was a computer problem. Got it resolved. I was able to make this program for you. It worked out. I was thinking, oh, no, we'll have to just say there's no show on Monday? What is this? How could there be no show, right? How could the sun not rise? You know, so here we are with the program for you guys. A couple of quick notes before we bring on Richard Mayberry by popular demand. First, I want to tell you guys, it looks like next week I will be talking to Steve Hogarth. Now, if you don't know who Steve Hogarth is, I'm going to put up a, let's see, what can I do for you guys who don't know who Steve Hogarth is? All right, I'm going to put up a page, tomwoods.com/Hogarth. It's just the way it sounds, H-O-G-A-R-T-H. I'm going to put up tomwoods.com/Hogarth, and it's going to have one video on it. And that's it. So I want you to check that out. Now, it's not for everyone, but if it's not for you, I think maybe there's something wrong with you, because I think really it is for everyone. So scratch what I said before. It really is for everyone. If you don't like it, I want you to listen until you do like it, pretty much. We're going to be talking to this guy next week. Secondly, you guys are really helping the show. You are really helping with expenses around here at no cost to yourself by entering Amazon at TomWoodsRadio.com. That is very, very much appreciated. Well, right now I want to bring onto the program here our old friend Richard Mayberry. Now, some of you guys know Richard Mayberry because he's the author of Whatever Happened to Penny Candy, which is a great introduction to economics for adolescents. He's also the author of Whatever Happened to Justice and other titles in the so-called Uncle Eric series. But he's actually the author of 22 books on a wide variety of subjects. And he's also the publisher of a financial newsletter, U.S. and World Early Warning Report. You can check that out at earlywarningreport.com. Richard, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Well, thanks. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, there are so many topics we could cover, given all the work you've done, that I thought maybe for this first time that we talk, we would do kind of a smorgasbord type of conversation. I want to start off, first of all, by having you say a little bit about the book that of all the titles of yours, and there are many, I have heard about by far the most from parents who are so happy that it opened the eyes of their kids and got them on the right path in terms of thinking about economics. And of course, that's Whatever Happened to Penny Candy. Let's talk about that one, and then I want to talk about Whatever Happened to Justice. So give me an overview of what somebody is going to find in that book, and then what the age range you're targeting is.
Well, the book is written for people who are 12 years old and older, it is designed to give you a understanding of economics that you're not going to get in school or college or anywhere else, because it's from the Austrian view rather than the Keynesian view. Almost everybody teaches the Keynesian view because Keynesianism is what the government uses. And, you know, what I say to the subscribers to my newsletter is if you follow the advice or use the model of the Keynesians, which the government uses, then it's logical to expect your investments to end up in the same condition as the economy. And do you want that? So I like the Austrian view because I think it's much more realistic. It's got a much better track record, and it explains things like the book explains things like inflation and depressions and recessions. There's a little on the velocity of circulation of money, and these sound like big topics that are very intimidating, and they are the way they're taught in most schools and colleges. But as I said, this book is written for 12-year-olds, and it just really turns a lot of people around and kind of opens their eyes to what's really going on. You know, because I don't use any of the jargon. I try to tell the principles to a person in a story sort of form that hooks into your own way of life. The book starts out by having you pull some coins out of your pocket and actually look carefully at the coins, because the, for instance, in a quarter has these notches around the edges. And believe it or not, those notches are very important in what is going on in the world today. They used to be a protection against the government's ability to debase the currency. They don't do that anymore. But the book explains these sorts of things in terms of things that you actually can touch and feel and see in your own life.
You know, I've sometimes thought that economics might just be too hard for younger people to understand. But the more I think about it, and then when I looked at your book, I thought, no, I've made a mistake here. There are some advanced concepts that they'll need to wait till later to understand. But if you get the fundamentals right, it can inoculate you against a lot of the nonsense that the kids are going to run into.
Yeah. One of the most interesting cases I ever ran into is a young woman. I would judge her to have been in her early 20s. We met at an investment conference where I was speaking, and she came up to me and she shook my hand, and she said she was so grateful that the help that I had given her. She had done very well in college, studying chemistry and physics and the higher math and all. She had no trouble with any of that, but when she came to economics, she couldn't get it. And she said she was beginning to be worried about herself. She thought that she had suffered some sort of brain damage, that she couldn't get this economics because she got all this other tough stuff. And she said then she picked up Whatever Happened to Penny Candy and my other books, and she said it just kind of, you know, the scales fell from her eyes, and she understood, and she realized that it wasn't her ability to understand that was faulty. It was what she was being taught that was faulty. And it changed her whole life. And at the time she met me, she had a very a good job, a high job in a financial firm, and was doing very well. And she was just so grateful for this ability to understand. And she got it by starting out with a book written for 12-year-olds.
You know, Richard, before we went on the air, you were saying in talking about your book, Whatever Happened to Justice, that this is in some ways the more important book, or it's in some ways logically prior, because if you get the law right, you were saying, then the economics just falls into place. What do you mean by that?
Right. As you know, I'm a great admirer of Friedrich Hayek, who was the 1974, I think it was, Nobel Prize winner in economics. And Hayek's main point was that, yeah, the economics is important. You should understand that. But the law is far more important. The law is the foundation of the civilization. And when governments corrupt the law, then it's pretty much hopeless. You cannot save your civilization if the government is corrupting the law. And what I point out in Whatever Happened to Justice is that during the 20th century, there was this movement away from rational law toward simple political expediency. The concept that there is not supposed to be any ethics in the law anymore, that we have to use the law to force people to change their ways of life to go in a direction that the government wants them to go. And this has wrecked the legal system, which means it has wrecked the foundation of our civilization. And again, it's very important to understand the economics, and I encourage everybody to do that. But essentially, if you want to save this civilization from going further downhill, we've got to start reforming the law and get it back to a system that contains ethics and logic.
Well, even though you just got done saying that that's the thing we should talk about, I still want to talk about the economy, because I want to ask, I have not seen your newsletter, which I guess is the U.S. and World Early Warning Report for Investors. I mm-hmm. haven't seen a copy of this. That's not a hint that you should send me one, by the way. I'm just saying that I just want to explain why I don't know what's in it. But what kind of thing do you, first of all, how often does it come out? And then what are you telling people now? I mean, I guess it might be very easy for people to say, well, something disastrous is going to happen. But then it becomes just as easy for the response to be, you know, you Austrians, you're always forecasting doom and gloom. So no wonder you wind up being right once every 20 years. What do you say to that?
Well, I think we've been right an awful lot more often than once every 20 years. I'm absolutely certain there is no other economic model that's been as accurate as the Austrian has for let's say 40 years or more. But the Austrian prescription is always that we've got to have less government. And so everybody who's political ignores it. And so, you know, the public generally doesn't hear much about it. As far as my newsletter is concerned, I try to look at the world scene, the big picture. I specialize in the big picture, which is not just U.S. economics, but world economics and geopolitics, military catastrophes, which are becoming very common, to put it all together into a single picture that an individual can use to guide his investment decision-making. And if I do say so myself, I think we've been doing a very good job. Now, the newsletter, it's called Early Warning Report, it comes out 10 times a year, and it's 8 pages each. And it's a kind of a practical application of all of these theoretical things that we talk about all the time, like law and economics, to give you the guidance you need for you to be successful in your own finances, your own way of life. But it also has a great deal of the explanations that you'll find in, for instance, the Uncle Eric books that I write, because it's absolutely necessary to understand these esoteric concepts that can be made simple if you try, and to see how they cause changes in human behavior. And you're seeing that right now all over the world. One of the amazing things to me is that during the 1990s, actually the period from 89 until 2007, geopolitics and military events were the main stories, and the investment markets responded very strongly to that. And then the economy crashed in 2007 and 8, and up until 2013, the economy was the really big news story. And now we are going back to the geopolitics and the military events is driving things. If you look at today's Wall Street Journal, I mean, it's geopolitics and warfare that's on the front page. I think there's almost like a cycle, maybe, in human history where it goes back and forth from the geopolitics and military stuff to economics and then back again. And I think we're at the ground floor stage again of this change in human behavior to the political stuff being more important than the economic stuff worldwide, and that's what's going to drive the investment changes from here on for years. We did really well from 89 to 2007 with our investment advice, and I think that there's a new tremendous change coming here. Another example of it is what's going on between Beijing and Tokyo. I mean, those people are crazy. They really are starting to recreate the conditions that led up to World War I and World War II, where you had all these governments forming alliances with each other. So this domino effect happened. In World War I, one man gets killed, and it leads to a world war that killed 16 million. And that's the type of behavior that both Beijing and Japan are beginning to demonstrate. Again, just, you know, history repeats, doesn't repeat exactly, but boy, there's a lot of similarities. And this is another one that's happening right now. And the mainstream media doesn't pay very much attention to this.
You have a book on World War I, and of course, 2014 is the centenary year of the beginning of that war. I had Paul Gottfried on a week or two ago, and we talked about World War I and the controversy over war guilt and these sorts of issues that persist among historians. But I was suggesting to him that it seems, at least on the surface of things, that if you're going to try to draw lessons from World War I for today, well, today's world is somewhat different from that of World War I. We don't have the alliance systems that existed at that time. We don't have a military rivalry between the British and the Germans. I mean, obviously, the specific examples are not quite right, but the main lesson that I drew from it that's useful for today is that today, just as 100 years ago, the foreign policy options that are available to the American public are basically either Woodrow Wilson or Theodore Roosevelt. But the idea of a William Jennings Bryan who just wants to stay out of it is borderline off the table. What types of parallels do you see between 100 years ago and now?
Yeah, exactly what you're saying. What happened 100 years ago for World War I is actually the more important part of it is the Spanish-American War. You know, the U.S. government in the 1890s got this idea that they were entitled to have this global empire, just like the European rulers did, and that it was a fine thing to go out and conquer other countries, kill a bunch of people, and take them over. And they did that in the Philippines, and Americans were thrilled with it. And there was this tremendous upsurge in patriotism and pride in our new empire, and this insane, well, I don't know what to call it, a horrible acute testosterone poisoning swept the country. And then along comes World War One, and the Americans were just set up perfectly to go marching off into that craziness over in Europe. And it was the Spanish-American War that set the tone for everything that has come after, World War One being the most noteworthy. And it's interesting to me, there are very few Americans around today that know anything about World War One, but that's actually probably more influential to our life today than World War II was. It's just farther away, and they've lost the memory of it. But it was in World War One that they got this idea that the alliances are a good thing, and that's being repeated now, and I think it is crucially dangerous. Washington has clearly signaled that they are willing to go to war over the Senkaku Islands just because the Japanese are trying to claim those islands against the Beijing, who also wants the islands. So Washington has committed American lives to fight and die over a bunch of rocks in the East China Sea. And that's the same kind of insanity that occurred in the lead up to World War One. These alliances that were formed and just, you know, when something went wrong, you get this domino effect and the whole world is in the thing.
Well, you know, even Dwight Eisenhower in the middle of the century, who was supposed to be a conservative man of restraint and moderation, threatened the use of nuclear weapons over Kamoi and Matsu, a couple of offshore islands off of Taiwan. Now, I mean, I understand why the Taiwanese have an interest in all that. But for heaven's sake, I mean, he came, I think, closer to nuclear war than even Kennedy wound up doing with Khrushchev and the Cuban Missile Crisis. And you're right that the Spanish-American War is the real watershed, because up to that point, yeah, there was U.S. expansion, but it was largely continental, and the idea of having an overseas influence was really foreign to most people. But then after Spanish-American War, it seems sort of automatic, even though there wasn't a whole lot of enthusiasm among the American public to get into World War One. You had to draft them, and you had to propagandize them for 18 months to get them to go do it. But once the blood got boiling in 1898, it just became, I think, an expectation that the U.S. is going to play a role in whatever the heck happens, wherever it happens.
Yeah, that's right. it's a real abomination in American history that the public was able to be talked into this so clearly and so easily. The Spanish-American War, the U.S. Army killed 200,000 Filipino men, women, and children. And the American public, like I say, was thrilled with it. They just thought it was wonderful, and now we have taken over this piece of land on the other side of the world, and it's now we're building an empire. Isn't that wonderful? It's gross. I think one of the things most entertaining that happen all the time is that Americans know their government lies to them constantly about the economy. You stop anybody, any American in the street, and you say, do you really believe what the government's telling you about the economy? And they'll all say, are you kidding? I wasn't born yesterday. I know that they're lying to me and that they don't have a clue what they're doing. But then you ask them in foreign policy, how do you think that Washington is dealing with Vladimir Putin in Russia? And, that's a good thing to do. We should get really tough with him. They are always completely behind the U.S. government's foreign policy. They think the government lies like crazy about the economy,
right,
but it tells the truth about foreign policy.
Right, and it's the same people. The same people are talking to you about domestic policy. You don't believe a word they say. Yeah, I make this point constantly, and you wouldn't believe how many conservatives suddenly stop when they hear this, and they say, you know what? You're right. Like, I don't believe anything they say about milk subsidies, but for some reason, I believe them on the most momentous issues of all.
That's right. Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it's all Washington has to do is paint this picture of some foreign devil that we have to go out and fight, and the population just falls in right behind them, and they get this all patriotic feeling and. It's just like a bunch of high school kids going to the football game on Friday night. This is a really serious thing, and we've got to beat the bad guys. It's that kind of a mentality.
Now, let me ask you, given that you're the publisher of a financial newsletter, obviously you don't like to give out free advice, but speaking just very generally, how are you steering people to hold on to wealth in this environment? I mean, that must be the question you get more than anything else. Because I've been reading people who have been stock market watchers for many years who say, I have no idea what to tell people right now. I don't know if I'd like to tell them that at least they could hold on to cash and that would be safe, but I'm not even sure that's safe. I'm not even sure what should be done, and I'm the expert. So how do you feel in this situation and in just very, very general terms, where would you send people, especially somebody, just an average guy who's got, $25,000 saved up and just doesn't know what to do with it?
Yeah, we need to back up a little bit and explain that my newsletter is not a trading newsletter. This is not in and out on a day-to-day basis. This is a long-term approach. And I rely on the two carved-in granite long-term trends in human history. One of them is war, and the other one is debasement of currencies, which usually goes along with war. Now, I think if you have your portfolio to set up to benefit from war and currency debasement, then in the long run, you're going to come out smelling like a rose, because those two trends are so solid, and events always return back to those two trends. So I think they're the best possible prediction you can make, and you just set up your portfolio to assume that those conditions are going to crop up again and again and again. And the number one approach in that is the precious metals. When things get really awful, people run to the precious metals. They run away from paper currencies and toward the precious metals. So the very first thing that everybody should own, I think you should have 10 to 20% of your net worth in bullion coins of gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, like the Canadian Maple Leafs, the American Eagles, those sorts of coins, because no matter what the government does, gold is still an element in the universe, and silver is still an element, and platinum and palladium. And the government can't change that fact, the supply of this stuff is limited. And go on beyond there, if you can, the Sprott Global Resources Funds, they hold these metals. You can use those for trading if you want to do that, but the coins themselves you should have in your hot little hand. And I think that the day is coming when gold, which is right now around $1,300 an ounce, is going to go to $10,000, just because there's so many people out there who don't have it yet, and they're going to recognize they're going to need it as the currency is debased, and they're going to run to it, and there'll be a panic to get into it. And silver, I think, will probably go from, it's about 20 right now, to probably 100. I would say platinum, probably the same as gold. And palladium, I would guess, probably around 700 or 800 would be my guess. And again, I mean, you know, the government can't create these things on a printing press, which is the number one reason you should own them. Have that in your mind more than anything else, is that you've got to have things that the government can't produce on a printing press.
Now, of course, this is something you should hold on to. These precious metals you should hold on to for the long haul, not thinking that I'm going to get rich quick with these things. That's not what they're for. And there can be short-run swings in one or the other direction. It's something to be held on in a sober way, not in a short-run speculative way. Now, what do you say, though, just as we wrap up, what do you say to those who say the concern about price inflation and currency debasement is so 30 years ago? I mean, for heaven's sake, we have had more monetary base expansion than we've ever seen in the history of the world, and prices, you know, more or less, consumer prices have stayed surprisingly flat. So it seems so out of date and out of fashion and backward and old-fashioned for you to be worrying about the debasement of the currency. Apparently, the experts have everything under control.
Yeah, it sure would look that way, wouldn't it? And that concerns something called velocity. And one of my little Uncle Eric books deals with that. It's called The Money Mystery. Most of the economists call it velocity. The Austrians call it money demand. They refer to that. It's actually the other side of the same coin. And it's simply a case where, in my mind anyhow, as the government has inflated the currency and done a whole lot of other stupid things, they've scared people so badly that people are hanging on to the money and they're not spending it. When we get to the point where there is some confidence out there and people aren't so scared anymore, then they're going to start spending. And all of that money that the government has created, most of which is still in the banks, is going to come out of the banks, and it's going to be just amazing. You're just going to have this enormous deluge of cash that's going to flow into the markets, and prices will take off. And we're already seeing the beginning of that, I think, in the stock market and in real estate. In 2012, the Fed announced that they were going to pump a whole lot of money into the stock market and into real estate in order to try to get the economy moving again. And, I warned my people, you know, this is coming. They're actually going to do it. And here's what you ought to buy. And anybody who took that advice is up, you know, like 40, 50% on their money, because that money is now flowing into those markets, driving up those prices. They might not be driving up the consumer price index, but that money is driving up the price of stocks and real estate, and I think that's going to continue for years yet. There will be some times when it's going to go down, but basically I think those two markets are in a long-term trend upward. You know, it's another way to make money off of this. And I don't know what else to say other than that. You really have to understand something about money demand and velocity to get what I'm talking about here, that there is a deluge coming And it's just a matter of time.
Richard, if people want to find out more about your work, what's the easiest way for them to do so?
Well, our 800 number is 800-509-5400, 800-509-5400. And we do have a special offer going now. The newsletter is regularly $300, but I can arrange for anybody who mentions Tom Woods to get it for, I think it's $170. So that's quite a discount. We have a website. There's a whole lot of material on the website. You really should go to the website and read the article about velocity and the other article about malinvestment. Both of those are crucially important for managing your money. You've got to understand those concepts.
So is the website earlywarningreport.com?
That will work, or Richard Mayberry will work. RichardMayberry.com.
Okay. Well, and Mayberry is M-A-Y-B-U-R-Y. Well, Richard Mayberry, I appreciate your time today. We've never had a chance to chat before, but I'm glad we did today. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody, remember my events coming up this Saturday, March 1st. The College of Southern Idaho, then March 5th, Washburn University at Topeka, Kansas, March 15th, University of Central Arkansas, April 9th, Florida Southern College, and then April 10th, Liberty University. So get details on those events, all of which are open to the public, at tomwoods.com. That's my personal site. tomwoods.com/events is the events page. All right, more great programs coming your way starting tomorrow. Sean Rittenour of Grove City College will join us. What makes the Austrian school different? We'll talk to him about that. More to come this week. How to start your own YouTube channel from somebody who's got tens of millions of views. That'll be some good advice and some fun chit-chat, but much more to come this week. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.